Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Will you stifle yourself?
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. Here's the number to call to be on the air, 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Just something for your good-to-know file. The United Methodist Church in the United States is experiencing yet another great schism within itself. After a controversial stance, this is according to MSN, after a controversial stance against same-sex marriage and LGBTQ clergy, members by a slim majority voted to remain together, to stay in the Southern Baptist, I'm sorry, United Methodist denomination, although two conferences met this last weekend, and are now, it looks as though upwards of 439 churches across Texas are poised to leave the denomination along with their properties. So that means their churches, whatever assets they may have. And this is all done by vote. And this all focuses on the leftward tilt of the United Methodist Church in the direction of gender ideology, LGBTQ stuff, same-sex marriages, all that stuff. And you've got a group of people who are saying that's something up with which we will not put, and we're not going to remain in this denomination if you're going to go in that direction. So there's a rending of this organization. But if you're a Catholic, you may say, well, what does that have to do with me? Well, it doesn't have to do anything with you directly, but it is a textbook example of what the Protestant rebellion has seen since the time of Martin Luther, this continuous fragmentation. Now, personally, I myself am very sympathetic to those more faithful members of the United Methodist denomination who are saying this is contrary to the gospel. These ideologies are contrary to what Jesus said. Where did Jesus say anything about LGBTQ? Well, how about Matthew 19, verse 1? In the beginning, God made them male and female. This is a verse I quote probably at least once a week. And there Jesus says that the paradigm for marriage and human sexuality is one man and one woman. That's it. No other combinations.
Full stop.
Yeah. Where is she? Like, I haven't seen her lately. I haven't heard her.
These people are hiding. They're hiding.
Oh, man. She just won't say it. All right. Did your hamburger come with a dose of misogyny today, Cyrus? All right.
Your hamburger comes with a dose of misogyny.
Yeah. I specifically asked for not a dose of misogyny.
I'm sorry to break it to you, Chad.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Full stop. So I'm empathetic to them. Oh, there she is.
She came out of hiding.
She interrupted me, though. Go ahead, madam.
Full stop.
Thank you. So I'm empathetic, but here's the point I want to make, because if you're a Catholic, you're saying, well, I'm not a United Methodist. What does this have to do with me? It's a history lesson. That's all. It's a history lesson. So the last 500 years of groups, people saying, we go by the Bible alone, and all right, cool. But you can't agree on what the Bible means. So from that initial three branches, Lutheran, Anabaptist, and Reformed or Calvinist, have grown now all these permutations and sub-permutations and sub-permutations. And ultimately, what we're seeing right now in these United States with the United Methodist denomination is exactly what has happened continuously for the last 500 years, which is where you have one group of people in a denomination who say, that's not what the Bible means. And that's being said, by the way, on both sides. So the people who are the more traditional conservative folk with whom I am very much simpatico, I very much understand and agree with them, they're saying, you guys, this LGBTQ stuff, that's not what the Bible says. And the LGBTQ people are saying, no, no, no. You're misunderstanding the Bible. You think that the Bible means, you know, homosexuality is bad and all this other stuff is bad. That's not what the Bible means. St. Paul's not talking about that. So here you have a textbook example of a battle that's being fought yet again on the basis of we go by the Bible, but they don't agree on what the Bible means. So sadly, tragically, this has been the lot of that phenomenon for 500 years now. It's just endless fragmentation, endless division, endless pulling away from each other and saying that's not what the Bible means. All of that based upon this notion that if you go by the Bible alone, you're guaranteed to get it right. And we have 500 years now worth of evidence to show that that is simply false. That's also known as sola scriptura, the idea of going by scripture alone. And each group will say, but we know the true meaning of scripture. But sooner or later, somebody in that group will eventually hive off and say, yeah, but it's different in this area or that area. So I don't, I'm not happy to see people being pulled apart like this. But on the other hand, I must say that I do have a sense of solidarity with those members of the United Methodist Church who are saying, we're not going to go down that road. We're not going to go in the direction of the gender ideology and where that takes people. So I agree with them, at least as far as that is concerned. 888-914-9149. Let's get over to Anna now in Houston. Hello, Anna. Did I catch you unawares?
The model works is, you know, your prenatal appointments will alternate.
Tell you what, uh-oh. Anna's not ready. So we'll let Anna, I don't want to embarrass her. So we will let Anna get ready and then we'll come back to her. Veronica in Oswego, Illinois, welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning. I have a question about the Old Testament tradition of giving your children a blessing. And is there a resource available now that can guide parents to give their children a Catholic blessing? And I have adult children, so I just have this sense that I need to do that. Can you recommend anything?
Yeah, well, there are books of blessings that you can get at a Catholic bookstore. And the ones that I've looked at before would include blessings for parents to give to their children. So I don't remember like a specific name, but it might be something mm-hmm. like Book of Blessings. I've seen them before.
Okay.
If you were to look at, say, a Catholic Book Publishing Company online, and I think their website is catholicbookpublishing.com, I encourage you to get whatever you wind up getting at a Catholic bookstore, you know, support them. Mm-hmm. But you might be able to pinpoint the one that you like the most and then buy it at your local Catholic bookstore. But that's the way I would go about doing it. If you want a formula blessing, you'll find it in a book like that. If you want to just do something extemporaneous, coming mm-hmm. out of your heart without some formula, that's obviously a good thing to do as well.
Of course, yeah. Great, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Nice to chat with you. Let's go to Aaron now in... Anna's gone. Okay. I thought Anna. All right, Anna, if you're listening, call back. Looks like your phone dropped, but we have space for you if you're interested. Let's go to Aaron now in Hastings, Michigan. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, Patrick. Thanks for taking my call. I left the Catholic Church, and I'm trying to come back, but mm-hmm. I also have so many
awesome.
Questions, and it seems like nobody's willing to sit down with me and talk to me.
Okay.
But I know
well,
that
here
you
I am.
Are, and...
I've just pulled up my chair, so let's go. Happy to.
The one question I have, what besides the Catholic Church do we have proof that Jesus Christ founded the Catholic Church?
Okay, great question. There is historical documentary proof that you can look at. So that would be something like the early church fathers. And there's a wealth of evidence from the earliest centuries about the Catholicity of the church. One book that comes to mind, it's a compendium of, it's indexed by doctrine. So let's just say the Mass as a sacrifice, the Eucharist as the real presence of Christ, body, blood, soul, and divinity, the veneration of Mary and the saints, praying for the souls of those who died, the authority of the Pope, etc. So this book is called The Fathers Know Best. It's published by Catholic Answers, and it's very comprehensive. And so if you wanted to, for example, say, well, let's see, what did the early Christians say about the Mass? It's all there. And so the quotes are provided from the various church fathers, and the date is given, and also the document from which this quote is taken is given. So you could verify it independently if you wanted to do that. So that would be one way to look at the documentary evidence from the witness of the early church. And the logic there, Aaron, is that here we are in very close in time to the time of Jesus and the apostles, and the apostolic era extended to the end of the first century. So we would have to take into account that these significant figures like Clement of Rome, who was the bishop of Rome, two or three after St. Peter died in Rome. And so now you have Clement, who's in Rome, writing a letter to the Corinthian church, which had been established by St. Paul. And he's giving them instructions and telling them that they need to obey what he's telling them, because if they disobey him, it's not really him they're disobeying, but God speaking through him. So this language is very redolent of the authority of the Bishop of Rome, as we understand it today. You see it in print right there, not even at the end of the first century. So he was writing somewhere maybe around the year 80 or 85. Some dated a little bit later, some dated even earlier than that. But let's just say for convenience sake, he was writing around the year 80. So at least a couple of the apostles were still alive. And you see this, or you see St. Ignatius of Antioch, who in the year 107, he was a very old man, and he was a disciple of St. John the Apostle. He learned the faith from the apostles, at least St. John, and it seems very likely also St. Peter. He knew them. He learned the faith from them. And in his seven epistles that he wrote on his way to be martyred in Rome, he's talking about the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. He's saying things like, if you meet somebody who doesn't believe what we believe, namely that the Eucharist is the very flesh of Jesus who suffered for our salvation on the cross, then stay away from that person because he's not teaching what we learned from the apostles, things of that nature, and many other things besides. What you'll see is that the early Christians were Catholic, and they called themselves Catholic. St. Ignatius of Antioch is one example, probably the earliest, in which he uses the term the Catholic Church to describe the church that Jesus established. So that's by the close of the first century, still within the apostolic era. And then the further out you go, the later you go, obviously over time, we've lost a lot of documents just because of fires and earthquakes and things that happen, and you just lose documents over time. But there's still so many of them that when you confront that evidence, I think what will happen, Aaron, is you will find what St. John Henry Newman found. He was an Anglican Protestant clergyman in the 19th century. He was born in the early 19th century. And so he was vehemently anti-Catholic and a great scholar. He was a Latinist, and he was fluent in Greek and Hebrew, and he was very intellectually capable. And he wanted to refute the Catholic Church's claims on issues like Marian doctrines or purgatory or the papacy. So he set about to write what he regarded to be the ultimate refutation of the Catholic Church's claims. And he got far enough into it that he just gave up and he became Catholic. And he has a famous line in the beginning of a book. The book he wound up writing is called, is a book on the development of doctrine. And he says early in this book, he says that to become deep in history is to cease to be Protestant. Now, he himself just underwent that metamorphosis, much to his great shock and surprise. He did not expect that he would wind up becoming Catholic, but he was intellectually consistent and honest, and he just couldn't explain away the evidence that the early church was thoroughly Catholic in every respect. And the other thing is that he couldn't find Protestantism anywhere in the early centuries of the church, you know, salvation by faith alone, or once saved, always saved, or sola scriptura, or some of the other, let's just say, peculiarities of the Protestant Reformation. He couldn't find those anywhere in the early church, but all he could find was the Catholic Church. So there's one way that you could, you know, investigate the evidence. It's plentiful and easy to obtain if you want to.
Okay, yeah, I'll definitely do that. What'd you say the name of the book was again?
That particular book is called The Fathers Know Best. It's a riff on that TV show from the 50s, Father Knows Best. So The Fathers Know Best. published by Catholic Answers. I would also recommend a book by Dr. Marcellino D'Ambrosio called When the Church Was Young. And he himself has a doctorate in patristics, which is the study of the early church fathers. I think he got his doctorate from Catholic University of America. A third book would be by Rod Bennett called The Four Witnesses. And that is an up-close and personal look at four of the earliest major early Christian documents. The Didache, for example, The Shepherd of Hermas. And I'm blanking on what the other... Oh, it's the Epistle of St. Clement to the Corinthians. And I'm blanking on what the fourth one is. But you've got the text of those documents and then commentary to help you sort through it. That's also a very helpful one.
Okay. Would you guys be able to mail me a list of those?
Unfortunately, no, but it's easy if you were to go back after about an hour after the show is over, the archive of the program is listed. So if you wanted to go back and re-listen, we're in the second hour, first section of the second hour. You could just grab a pen and paper and jot them down as you re-listen to it. It'll be easy.
All right. Yeah, absolutely. I will do that. Thank you.
You're welcome. And Aaron, you have a standing invitation. Anytime you want to call in and discuss, I'm here for you.
All right. Great. Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you. 888-914-9149. Great. Anna is back, and we'll come right back to Anna on the other side of this timeout. So Anna and everyone else holding, I'm coming right to you right after this. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find out more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
The former, not el presidente, but la presidente of Argentina. She was also the vice president, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. She was just convicted and sentenced to 6 years in prison and a lifetime ban from holding public office due to a fraud scheme that she was convicted of or accused of, embezzling $1 billion through public works projects during her presidency. Seriously, Cyrus, no kidding. Fraud in politics? Can you believe it? Embezzling money?
And does she get to keep this $1 billion? Because 6 years for $1 billion ain't so bad.
That's a good question. So according to the Washington Times, a three-judge panel found the Peronis leader guilty of fraud but rejected a charge of running a criminal organization for which the sentence could have been 12 years in prison. They're in the appeals process, blah, blah, blah. She denied all accusations.
Argentina's she's like, how much leader. Is it going to cost to get this down to six?
If we needed to write a check
I've got some
to
money.
Streamline things. Yeah, I could see that being done. It doesn't mention that she's doing that. She's 69 years old. She directed 51 public works projects to a friend who is a construction magnate. And so self-enrichment, embezzling up to $1 billion, and she's going to put on an orange jumpsuit and go to the big house for a while. So that's happening. I didn't know if you had any plans to go to Argentina anytime soon. But
it's hard to shed a tear for people that are scamming the less fortunate.
So you're saying don't cry for her, Argentina?
I just threw you a softball and
that
hit
was
it
so
out of the
easy.
Park. Yeah.
That was so easy. I went to Evita's grave in it's actually bigger than just a grave. It's like a little mausoleum in an absolutely stupendous cemetery in the middle of Buenos Aires, Argentina. Nancy and I spent, I don't know, hours and hours there. Not at her particular mausoleum, but it's there if you want to go see where Evita is buried. We did. It's worth the time if you ever go to Argentina. If you have any plans to go to Argentina anytime soon, Cyrus, I would make that cemetery It's like a city within a city, but it's just all monuments. How do we get on that topic? I don't know. Let's get back to the phones. Yeah, let's go back to, okay, Anna is ready. Let's go to Anna in Houston. Good morning, Anna.
Yes, hi, good morning. Sorry if my signal cuts off. It's kind of shaky. My question is, okay. Is it a sin to attend a Hindu temple during Diwali? In this case, like one of the most celebrated, you know, festivals in Hinduism. Mm-hmm. And I ask this because I try to invite my friend over to like services for Christmas or Easter, and he comes back and tells me, well, come to my celebration. But, mm-hmm. you know, I can't help but think of, you know, Leviticus 26, Acts 15, 29, 1 Corinthians 10, of, I don't know, I guess my spirit is not at peace.
Mm-hmm. Are you still there?
Oh, I think she just dropped.
She dropped. Oh, boy. Well, Anna, I think I got enough of your question. Sorry that your phone dropped, but I think I got enough of your question. I'm reminded of something interesting as you were bringing up these Bible passages. St. Paul found himself in Athens, and he was walking along what's known as the Areopagus. And it's really fascinating because he was in the middle of an area. This is an avenue that was filled with temples to pagan gods. So Zeus and all these various other gods, both Roman and Greek gods. And this is in Acts chapter 17, by the way. So he's on the Areopagus. He's walking through where all these temples are. And he says, he just starts declaiming in a loud voice, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription, to an unknown God. What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you." And from there he goes into an exposition of who this unknown God really is, and that is God himself, the King of Kings. And he talks about Jesus. And we're told that when he was done, some of them mocked him, but others said, well, we'll listen again sometime. Some men joined him and believed and joined the church. Not everybody did. Most of them probably didn't. But the reason this passage in Acts 17 comes to my mind as you raised your question is because he was not afraid of going in the midst of a place where there were shrines to these pagan gods. And the reason is because he wasn't there to participate. He wasn't there to engage in religious rituals or anything like that. Far from it. He was there to observe and then to share the truth of Jesus with these people. And he had a perfect example, a perfect pretext. I don't mean that in a bad sense. But he had a perfect reason to do this because he saw that they had this shrine to the unknown God. So it was the perfect opening for him to be able to do that. So that would be my thought, that if you're going and you're observing, you're just going to be present, you're not going to participate or do some sort of a ritual, I can see room for that. On the other hand, you shouldn't engage in Hindu rituals of any kind. That would not be compatible with your faith in Jesus. So I would suggest maybe looking at it that way. And if you felt as though that would be a little too much and you just don't want to be associated, even just by being there to observe, I could completely understand that as well. Thanks for the question. Let's go to Victoria now in Whittier, California. Hi, Victoria. I'm told you're 10 years old. Is that right?
Yeah.
Hello
Hi,
there.
Patrick.
Hi. Hey, I have a question for you before you ask me your question. Do you know of a Catholic church in your town called Our Lady of the Assumption, or St. Mary of the Assumption, rather? Do you know that Catholic church?
Yeah.
Well, guess what? That's the church I was baptized in 62 years ago. Can you believe it?
Yeah.
You sound impressed.
I am.
I can tell. Anyway, go ahead and ask me your question, Victoria.
So I have two questions. First, does God have a gender?
No, he's not male or female like we are because we have bodies. He's a pure spirit. So he is a father, but he's not a man, like your dad is a man, or he's not a woman like your mom is a woman.
So if God doesn't have a gender, then why do we call God him?
Very good question. The reason is because God is a father in that from all eternity, he has, we say, eternally generated the Son. Now, I don't mean the sun in the sky. I mean the Son, Jesus, the second person of the Trinity. And here's a way you can think about that. Think about for a second, think about yourself for a second here. Now, get a mental image of yourself in your mind, like what you look like, what your voice sounds like, the things you like, your memories, your relationships. Do you have an idea in your mind about you if you're trying to imagine yourself?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, that idea of you that you're thinking about right now, it's not you, right? It's an idea about you. It's not you, though, right?
Yeah.
Right. But it's in you. It's that idea is in your mind. So it's distinct from you, but it's in you. It's in your mind. So that might be a way to think a little bit about from all eternity, there's never a time when God didn't exist. And he's always known himself, like if you look in a mirror. So the first example was you get an idea of yourself in your mind. Another way of thinking about it would be to look in a mirror and you see a reflection of yourself. So in a way much more profound than those ways, from all eternity, God knows himself in a way kind of like looking in a mirror, in a way kind of like having an idea of himself. And so because God is infinite, meaning that there's no limit to his knowledge or his beauty or his goodness, that means that the idea that God has of himself, or what the Bible calls the Word of God, you can read about this in John chapter 1, for example, beginning in verse 1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Well, that's the second person of the Trinity. So from all eternity, God knowing himself, seeing this image, this perfect image of himself that is distinct from him but not separate from him, that is a person too. That is the Son. So the reason that we say that God is a Father is because from all eternity, this act of generating, or the creed says begetting, which is another way for saying generating, this, the second person of the Trinity, that's the relationship between a father and a son. And then the third person of the Trinity, the Holy Spirit, is the love between the Father and the Son, which also is unlimited. It's also distinct from them, but not separate from them. And that is the third person of the Trinity, the Holy Spirit. So we call God him for two reasons, fundamentally. One is because he gave us his pronouns in Scripture. So when he would speak to Moses, or when he would speak to Abraham or some of the other significant figures in the Old Testament, he always revealed himself to them in a male form, not because he's a man, but because he's a father. And so it was the easiest way for us to understand the fatherhood of God. And also when Jesus came to be with us, and going back to John chapter 1, it says in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. That's referring to Jesus. And in verse 14, it says, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. That's Jesus. That's little baby Jesus born in the manger. And so Jesus, who is the Son of God, revealed the Father to us more and more, and it was always as a father and always in masculine terms. Not, again, not because God is a man, like with a body. He's a pure spirit, but the way in which he generates and the way in which he interacts with his creation is in a way most closely associated with what we understand to be masculine. So it's for those two reasons primarily. Is that too much information, Victoria? Could you follow that okay?
No. Yeah, it's okay. I like things to be well explained.
Good. Well, hopefully I did a good job on that one. But the thing to remember is that Jesus, being the Son of God, he reveals the Father to us, and he always revealed God as in a masculine way. Again, doesn't mean that God is a man. So we could say that God has given us his pronouns, and his pronouns are not she, her, they're he, him. Helpful?
Thank you. Yeah.
You're welcome. Can I ask you a question before you go? You're 10, so I'm assuming that you've already made your first Holy Communion, but you probably haven't yet been confirmed. Is that right?
I did make my first communion, but I haven't been confirmed yet.
Got it. That's what I thought. You'll probably get confirmed in a couple more years, most likely. So do you go to a Catholic school, or where do you go to school?
I go to school in Pico Rivera in St. Mary Ann School.
Nice. I know that area. Well, I'm happy for you. And your mom is probably right there, right next to you, right?
Yeah, she's driving me to school right now.
Oh, nice. Well, please tell your mom I said thank you for letting you call.
She said thank you.
You're welcome. Great talking to you, Victoria. Thanks, and do well in school today. Let's go to Terry now in Cottage Grove, Minnesota. Hi, Terry.
Good morning. So I was reading Frank Sheed's book, Theology and Sanity, and in that book, he says that Adam was perfect. He had the perfection that was proper to him. And so if he's perfect as a whole, and he's made of parts, so he's got a perfect body and a perfect soul. So the soul has to be perfect, and the soul reasons. The reason ruled, right?
Right.
So he had to have a perfect will, and the first law of reason says the acceptance of God, and God said, "Do not eat of the fruit, or you shall die." So he has to have a perfect body, perfect soul, perfect reason, and perfect will, and that would be in harmony with God, but something went wrong in there, and he sinned. So I'm missing a defect. Is there a defect in there? Or
yes, your logic is not defective, but I think there's part of the equation or part of the question that might be missing. So yes to all the things that you just said, but let's remember that the term "perfect" in this context doesn't mean perfection in the sense that God is perfect, meaning that his will is inviolable. That he's, in the case of God, he's not subject to external forces that we are. So passions that we human beings have to contend with, God, of course, does not. So when we say that Adam was perfect, it's in a restricted and limited sense. But still, he was created by God in a state of perfection, in a state of original grace and original justice. What I think we have to add to this is that Adam, having complete mastery over his bodily passions and his intellect, ruled and mastered his irascible appetites, etc. So his will predominated over his bodily passions, unlike ours, because we have concupiscence as a result of the fall, but he didn't have that. So it seems that the missing piece is temptation. So in spite of the fact that he had these perfections that he was created with by God, he was also vulnerable to temptation. And temptation, as you know, is what came to him in the form of the dragon tempting Eve, and then she telling him to eat the fruit. So this is what made his sin so malicious. The malice of the sin is so much more, it's exponentially worse than it would be if you and I were in that situation. That is because he wasn't encumbered by those defects that we inherited from him as a result of the sin. That's what made his choice so devastating, is because he did not have to, you know, he wasn't dealing with passions the way we do. He wasn't dealing with the temptations the way we would. He was stone cold sober, and he did it anyway. So maybe that would be part of the temptation component. The other part too would be that the perfection of his human nature that he had been created with by God did not preclude making a choice against God. And that resides in his free will. So that in his free will, if it would have been impossible for him to choose evil, then he would have been deprived of a free will, in which case he couldn't have responded to God with love. So this is part of that somewhat mysterious interplay between the graces that God gave him and his willingness to part with all that, knowing what he knew. Now, an analogy, I'll throw it back to you, Terry, in a second, but an analogy to that would be the test of the angels, who were created perfect by God. They were perfect in every respect. There was no blemish or taint or weakness in any of the angels, and they too had to undergo a test. And we know that some of them failed, and in a way analogous to Adam's failure, their sin was egregious and malicious because they didn't have to deal with any of those problems that I talked about earlier that human beings do. So even they fell, and the temptation, it seems, is what is that missing component, because they were tempted in that moment to prefer themselves and their own beauty and their own power as opposed to recognizing God as their creator. So we see it twice, both with Adam and with the angels. What do you think, Terry?
Hello? Oh, okay. Yeah. That's the perfect, I think that's what I was missing. But also, do you think Adam knew what death was? Because if I was tempted, nothing could tempt me enough to know that I was going to die afterwards, like jump off a cliff. Mm-hmm. So did he know what death was, since there was no death around him?
Well, we know from Romans 5 that through Adam's sin, death entered the world. Now, that's a bit tricky because it seems that from all the scientific evidence that we have, that human beings were created long, 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 long after earlier forms of life. So if this is the paradigm that we're looking at, it seems that death, as far as human beings were concerned, did not exist prior to the fall. But death as such of insects, plants, animals, etc., in a natural order, could easily have existed for long before then. And then Adam in the garden was immune from death, and the death that's spoken of in Romans chapter 5 with regard to humanity had not yet entered in. That's one way to look at it. It's the way I tend to look at it. So did he know what death was? In a strict sense, it's hard to say, because there was nothing he ever experienced that involved death. So he didn't have any experience with death, and maybe it was only theoretical. And I'm assuming he had infused knowledge that God had given him even before the fall. So as a concept, he understood it. God warned them about it. On the day you eat of this fruit, you shall surely die, God said. So he must have understood that in some sense. But, you know, how he understood it, I guess I could only speculate. Great question, though, Terry. Thank you. I wish I had more time for topics like that, or any other topic for that matter. Give me a try, 888-914-9149.
Follow Patrick on Twitter, at Patrick Madrid.
You know, we receive over 1 million prayer requests every year, thanks in part to the Catholic Order of Foresters studio line, helping us stay connected to your intentions. Learn how our sponsor can support your family with life insurance at relevantradio.com/Forester. An Illinois Life Insurance Society, not available in all states.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
Wow, heavy duty. 888-914-9149. You may remember I shared with you not that long ago, a couple months maybe, a Franciscan friar of the Renewal, Father Fidelis Mosinski. He and three other pro-life advocates were arrested for trespassing at a Planned Parenthood center. They were arrested mid-December. Actually, it was a little more recent than that, so December 22nd. They were participating in a pro-life ministry called Red Rose Rescue at an abortion facility in Trenton, New Jersey. He, long story short, has had all the charges against him dropped. Happy to report that. He is at the same time facing federal charges under the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act, a 1994 law that prohibits the blocking of access to abortion clinics for an attempt to halt operations and save lives at a New York City abortion clinic in July, which is when I originally reported that to you. He has served jail time for his Red Rose rescue efforts before. Typically, a rescue involves a pro-life advocate entering the waiting room of an abortion facility to offer a Red Rose along with pro-life literature. He was represented by the Thomas More Society. And so at least those charges, according to this article, and this article, by the way, is from the National Catholic Register, the charges were subsequently dismissed per the prosecutor's request, according to the law firm's press release. The dismissal of the charges against these pro-life advocates brings an end to this saga, a long saga in this case. So I wanted to bring you up to date on that story because when we talked about it originally, it was unknown what would happen to him. So I'm happy to report that those charges were dropped. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to David in San Antonio. Good morning, David.
Yes, I'm a veteran, and I was assigned to West Germany, and I wanted to bring up three facts I saw when I was assigned there. I was assigned to three border camp tours on the western border, two on East Germany and one in Czechoslovakia. Okay. And in those countries, the state raised the kids, and the parents had no say. Yet mm-hmm. those people, faithful to the Lord, were liberated. Now, I have no doubt this is just going to be a blip on the radar screen, because when the revolution was over and George Washington was asked, how did you win? He said, it was the Lord who led us to freedom. And the only thing I'm doing now is praying for the Lord to take these people who are misguided and misled to return back like the prodigal son to the family, the body of Christ.
You know, one thing that I can say that tracks with what you're saying, David, is that this is a great reminder of why Relevant Radio being here is so important, because we can assist with that very goal that you're describing. 24/7, anybody listening can hear what you're talking about, you know?
Oh, definitely. And like I said, in my time in the service, I had no fear because someone goes, aren't you worried? No, I'm in the hands of God. His will be done. So I know nothing will happen that isn't his will. I'm just praying for those poor people living under communism. The Christians mm-hmm. are being persecuted, yet they're still being strong, and then their freedom did come.
Yeah, that's a good point. And we can pray and should pray that the same will happen now. God works in mysterious ways, as the saying goes, and he writes straight with crooked lines, as the saying goes. So even though we're living in a time of great confusion and upheaval and oppression, we can hope and pray that God will work miracles like he did in other situations before that. Excellent point, David. I appreciate that. Thank you. Let's go to Maggie now in Oak Park, Illinois. Hi, Maggie.
Good morning. I'd like to circle back, to Mr. Rogers. And I want to just, I have two parts, though. Mr. Rogers, I wanted to let you know that it's a little known fact that his wife did an interview that he, when he had a little song out, he has a little song. My grandchildren sing it every night, and it's called Good Night, God. And he just says, mm-hmm. thank you for this very special day. And it's just a little short song, but it's a wonderful mm-hmm. good night prayer. And he would do that at the end of his show, and PBS told him he couldn't do that because of the word God. He said, okay, then I won't be here. And he left for 3 years. And then PBS went and found him and said, okay, you can do it. You can talk about God.
Oh, PBS, with their silly PBS yes. notions.
I know.
Yeah, I can believe that. I never heard that before, yes. but that makes sense.
Yeah, it's in his, I believe, his wife did an interview, and she put that out there. I was very surprised.
By the way, if you don't mind, I was reading just the other day, just yesterday, in fact, that PBS, for whatever reasons, is getting more and more difficult for them in terms of their fundraising, and they're squeezed financially. So in the back of my mind, Maggie, I was thinking, maybe this will be God's providence that as PBS has to shed radio stations, maybe Relevant Radio can be in a position to reposition those radio stations and start talking more about God than the listeners would ever have heard on PBS stations. We'll see what happens.
My prayers as I go daily. Thank you. But my question is, every morning I listen to Daybreak with Paul Sadek. And when the 10 Minutes with Jesus segment comes up, every priest says that little prayer. And says, you know, Saint Joseph, he says, a Mother Immaculate, our Mother Immaculate, and Saint Joseph, our Father and Lord, intercede for us. Where does calling Joseph Lord fit there? I don't understand that.
You know, I'm not familiar with the prayer. Could you say the line? Do you know it by heart?
Yes. Well, it goes, you know, like, it's our Mother Immaculate and Saint Joseph, our Father and Lord, intercede for us.
Okay. Well, I would understand. I'm not familiar with the prayer, but I would understand the word Lord in the same manner that we would use the word in an archaic way in English. The Lord was like a title of somebody who is above you. Even the word Monsignor is simply my Lord. So it's what we call priests who have that honor. We call them Monsignor, and we're literally saying my Lord from the French. So it doesn't mean that we look at Father McGill or Monsignor McGillicuddy, as the case may be. We don't look at him as God. It's just a title of honor. And in this human sense, it's being applied to St. Joseph in that way, but it doesn't conflict with the Lord being the Lord in a capital L sense, if that's what you mean.
Oh, wonderful.
That's what you're wondering about.
Yes, wonderful. Yeah. Thank you. It drove me crazy every morning, and I've been meaning to call. Like, why are we doing this? But that makes so much sense.
You're welcome, Maggie. Great talking to you. Thank you. How about Tess now in Anton, Arizona? Anton or Anthem?
Yes, hi. Anthem, Arizona.
It says Anton for some reason, but that's okay.
Oh,
I know
sorry.
What Anthem is. I've spoken in Anthem, Arizona before.
Yes. I saw you. We were there at your, when you came to St. Rose.
Yes, I remember it well. Well, thank you for attending that.
Yes. My question is about Adam and Eve. Ever since, I have believed that Adam and Eve were real persons and a real story. But when I read The Great Adventure by Jeff Cavins, I think it was the introduction, and it spoke about how to read the Bible, and that it said there was a literary sense and a spiritual sense. And under literary sense, there were different types. And one of them was like said that it could, the Adam and Eve stories and other stories could have been inspired metaphors. And so from then on, I was teaching that. And then I heard you say that, no, Adam and Eve are historical persons. Mm-hmm. But if you say they are historical persons, then how could Seth have married out of the family when Cain and Abel were?
I can resolve that for you. So let me say is that simply to reiterate that the church says that Adam and Eve are real historical people, our first parents, and that they themselves are the progenitors of the whole human race. In other words, all of us go back to that historical couple. And you can see this in many places. One place that comes to my mind would be the encyclical by Pope Pius XII called Humani Generis, which is on the human race, and he himself kind of touches upon this topic. So he says in section 37, when, however, there is a question of another conjectural opinion, namely polygenism, and polygenism is this notion that there were many Adams and Eveses, that there were multiple humans that God created, and that the human race descended from these various couples. Mm-hmm. The Pope says the children of the church by no means enjoy such liberty to entertain that notion. He says, for the faithful cannot embrace that opinion, which maintains that either after Adam there existed on this earth true men who did not take their origin through natural generation from him, as from the first parent of all, or that Adam represents a certain number of first parents. It is in no way apparent how such an opinion could be reconciled with that which the sources of revealed truth and the documents of the teaching of the authority of the church propose with regard to original sin, which proceeds from a sin actually committed by an individual Adam and which through generation is passed on to all and is in everyone as his own, referring there to original sin. So that's one section. It's one of many, but here he just hammers home Adam was a real historical man and the human race descends from him and from Eve. Now, sounds like you had more that you wanted to ask me, Tess. So if you do, stand by. And when I come back from this quick break, I'll come back to you and we'll see if there's more to your question. That last document I just mentioned, Humani Generis, by Pope Pius XII, and we'll get a link to that for you if you want to read it for yourself. Just check out the show Twitter feed at P Madrid Show.